Chapter 5. Marguerite. In a moment, the pleasant oak-raftered coffee room of the inn became the scene of hopeless confusion and discomfort. At the first announcement made by the stable boy, Lord Antony, with a fashionable oath, had jumped up from his seat and was now giving many and confused directions to poor bewildered Jellyband, who seemed at his wit's end what to do.
"For goodness sake, man," admonished his lordship, "try to keep Lady Blakeney talking outside for a moment while the ladies withdraw." "Zounds," he added, with another more emphatic oath, "this is most unfortunate." "Quick, Sally, the candles!" shouted Jellyband, as, hopping about from one leg to another, he ran hither and thither, adding to the general discomfort of everybody. The Comtesse, too, had risen to her feet, rigid and erect, trying to hide her excitement beneath more becoming sang-froid. She repeated mechanically, "I will not see her. I will not see her." Outside, the excitement attended upon the arrival of very important guests grew apace.
"Good day, Sir Percy. Good day to your ladyship. Your servant, Sir Percy," was heard in one long-continued chorus, with alternate more feeble tones of, "Remember the poor blind man of your charity, lady and gentleman."
Then suddenly a singularly sweet voice was heard through all the din.
"Let the poor man be, and give him some supper at my expense."
The voice was low and musical, with a slight sing-song in it, and a faint soupçon of foreign intonation in the pronunciation of the consonants. Everyone in the coffee-room heard it and paused, instinctively listening to it for a moment. Sally was holding the candles by the opposite door, which led to the bedrooms upstairs, and the Comtesse was in the act of beating a hasty retreat before that enemy who owned such a sweet musical voice. Suzanne reluctantly was preparing to follow her mother, whilst casting regretful glances towards the door, where she hoped still to see her dearly beloved erstwhile schoolfellow. Then Jellyband threw open the door, still stupidly and blindly hoping to avert the catastrophe which he felt was in the air, and the same low musical voice said, with a merry laugh and mock consternation,
"Brr! I am as wet as a herring. Dear, has anyone ever seen such a contemptible climate?"
"Suzanne, come with me at once. I wish it," said the Comtesse peremptorily.
"Oh, Mama," pleaded Suzanne.
My lady, came in feeble accents from Jellyband, who stood clumsily trying to bar the way.
"Pardieu, my good man," said Lady Blakeney with some impatience, "what are you standing in my way for, dancing about like a turkey with a sore foot? Let me get to the fire. I am perished with the cold."
And the next moment Lady Blakeney, gently pushing mine host on one side, had swept into the coffee-room. There are many portraits and miniatures extant of Marguerite Saint-Just, Lady Blakeney as she was then, but it is doubtful if any of these really do her singular beauty justice. Tall, above the average, with magnificent presence and regal figure, it is small wonder that even the Comtesse paused for a moment in involuntary admiration before turning her back on so fascinating an apparition. Marguerite Blakeney was then scarcely 25, and her beauty was at its most dazzling stage. The large hat, with its undulating and waving plumes, threw a soft shadow across the classic brow with the aureole of auburn hair, free at the moment from any powder. The sweet, almost childlike mouth, the straight, chiselled nose, round chin, and delicate throat, all seemed set off by the picturesque costume of the period. The rich blue velvet robe moulded in its every line the graceful contour of the figure, whilst one tiny hand held, with a dignity all its own, the tall stick adorned with a large bunch of ribbons which fashionable ladies of the period had taken to carrying recently. With a quick glance all round the room, Marguerite Blakeney had taken stock of everyone there. She nodded pleasantly to Sir Andrew Ffoulkes, whilst extending a hand to Lord Antony.
"Hello, my Lord Tony. Why, what are you doing here in Dover?"
she said merrily. Then, without waiting for a reply, she turned and faced the Comtesse and Suzanne. Her whole face lighted up with additional brightness as she stretched out both arms towards the young girl.
"Why, if that isn't my little Suzanne over there! Pardieu, little citizeness, how came you to be in England? And Madame, too."
She went up effusively to them both, with not a single touch of embarrassment in her manner or in her smile. Lord Tony and Sir Andrew watched the little scene with eager apprehension. English though they were, they had often been in France, and had mixed sufficiently with the French to realize the unbending hauteur, the bitter hatred with which the old noblesse of France viewed all those who had helped to contribute to their downfall. Armand Saint-Just, the brother of beautiful Lady Blakeney, though known to hold moderate and conciliatory views, was an ardent republican. His feud with the ancient family of Saint-Cyr, the rights and wrongs of which no outsider ever knew, had culminated in the downfall, the almost total extinction of the latter. In France, Saint-Just and his party had triumphed, and here in England, face to face with these three refugees driven from their country, flying for their lives, bereft of all which centuries of luxury had given them, there stood a fair scion of those same republican families which had hurled down a throne and uprooted an aristocracy whose origin was lost in the dim and distant vista of bygone centuries. She stood there before them, in all the unconscious insolence of beauty, and stretched out her dainty hand to them, as if she would, by that one act, bridge over the conflict and bloodshed of the past decade.
"Suzanne, I forbid you to speak to that woman," said the Comtesse sternly, as she placed a restraining hand upon her daughter's arm.
She had spoken in English, so that all might hear and understand, the two young English gentlemen, as well as the common innkeeper and his daughter. The latter literally gasped with horror at this foreign insolence, this impudence before her ladyship, who was English, now that she was Sir Percy's wife, and a friend of the Princess of Wales to boot. As for Lord Antony and Sir Andrew Ffoulkes, their very hearts seemed to stand still with horror at this gratuitous insult. One of them uttered an exclamation of appeal, the other one of warning, and instinctively both glanced hurriedly towards the door, whence a slow, drawly, not unpleasant voice had already been heard. Alone among those present, Marguerite Blakeney and the Comtesse de Tournay had remained seemingly unmoved. The latter, rigid, erect, and defiant, with one hand still upon her daughter's arm, seemed the very personification of unbending pride. For the moment, Marguerite's sweet face had become as white as the soft fichu which swathed her throat, and a very keen observer might have noted that the hand which held the tall beribboned stick was clenched and trembled somewhat. But this was only momentary. The next instant the delicate eyebrows were raised slightly, the lips curved sarcastically upwards, the clear blue eyes looked straight at the rigid Comtesse, and with a slight shrug of the shoulders,
"Hoity-toity, citizeness," she said gaily, "what fly stings you, pray?"
"We are in England now, madame," rejoined the Comtesse coldly, "and I am at liberty to forbid my daughter to touch your hand in friendship. Come, Suzanne." She beckoned to her daughter, and without another look at Marguerite Blakeney, but with a deep, old-fashioned curtsy to the two young men, she sailed majestically out of the room. There was silence in the old inn parlour for a moment, as the rustle of the Comtesse's skirts died away down the passage. Marguerite, rigid as a statue, followed with hard, set eyes the upright figure as it disappeared through the doorway. But as little Suzanne, humble and obedient, was about to follow her mother, the hard, set expression suddenly vanished, and a wistful, almost pathetic and childlike look stole into Lady Blakeney's eyes. Little Suzanne caught that look. The child's sweet nature went out to the beautiful woman, scarce older than herself. Filial obedience vanished before girlish sympathy. At the door she turned, ran back to Marguerite, and putting her arms round her, kissed her effusively. Then only did she follow her mother. Sally, bringing up the rear, with a pleasant smile on her dimpled face, and with a final curtsy to my lady. Suzanne's sweet and dainty impulse had relieved the unpleasant tension. Sir Andrew's eyes followed the pretty little figure until it had quite disappeared. Then they met Lady Blakeney's with unassumed merriment. Marguerite, with dainty affectation, had kissed her hand to the ladies as they disappeared through the door. Then a humorous smile began hovering round the corners of her mouth.
"So that's it, is it?" she said gaily. "La, Sir Andrew, did you ever see such an unpleasant person? I hope when I grow old I shan't look like that."
She gathered up her skirts, and assuming a majestic gait, stalked towards the fireplace.
"Suzanne," she said, mimicking the Comtesse's voice, "I forbid you to speak to that woman."
The laugh which accompanied this sally sounded perhaps a trifle forced and hard, but neither Sir Andrew nor Lord Tony were very keen observers. The mimicry was so perfect, the tone of the voice so accurately reproduced, that both the young men joined in a hearty, cheerful bravo.
"Ah, Lady Blakeney," added Lord Tony, "how they must miss you at the Comédie Française, and how the Parisians must hate Sir Percy for having taken you away."
"A lad, man," rejoined Marguerite with a shrug of her graceful shoulders, "'tis impossible to hate Sir Percy for anything. His witty sallies would disarm even Madame la Comtesse herself."
The young Vicomte, who had not elected to follow his mother in her dignified exit, now made a step forward, ready to champion the Comtesse should Lady Blakeney aim any further shafts at her. But before he could utter a preliminary word of protest, a pleasant, though distinctly inane, laugh was heard from outside, and the next moment an unusually tall and very richly dressed figure appeared in the doorway. Chapter 6 An Exquisite of 92. Sir Percy Blakeney, as the chronicles of the time inform us, was in this year of grace 1792 still a year or two on the right side of 30. Tall, above the average, even for an Englishman, broad-shouldered and massively built, he would have been called unusually good-looking, but for a certain lazy expression in his deep-set blue eyes, and that perpetual inane laugh which seemed to disfigure his strong, clearly cut mouth. It was nearly a year ago now that Sir Percy Blakeney, baronet, one of the richest men in England, leader of all the fashions, and intimate friend of the Prince of Wales, had astonished fashionable society in London and Bath by bringing home from one of his journeys abroad a beautiful, fascinating, clever French wife. He, the sleepiest, dullest, most British Britisher that had ever set a pretty woman yawning, had secured a brilliant matrimonial prize, for which, as all chroniclers aver, there had been many competitors. Marguerite Saint-Just had first made her debut in artistic Parisian circles at the very moment when the greatest social upheaval the world has ever known was taking place within its very walls. Scarcely 18, lavishly gifted with beauty and talent, chaperoned only by a young and devoted brother, she had soon gathered round her in her charming apartment in the Rue Richelieu a coterie which was as brilliant as it was exclusive. Exclusive, that is to say, only from one point of view. Marguerite Saint-Just was from principle and by conviction a republican. Equality of birth was her motto. Inequality of fortune was, in her eyes, a mere untoward accident. But the only inequality, she admitted, was that of talent. Money and titles may be hereditary, she would say, but brains are not. And thus her charming salon was reserved for originality and intellect, for brilliance and wit, for clever men and talented women, and the entrance into it was soon looked upon in the world of intellect, which, even in those days and in those troublous times, found its pivot in Paris, as the seal to an artistic career. Clever men, distinguished men, and even men of exalted station formed a perpetual and brilliant court round the fascinating young actress of the Comédie Française, and she glided through republican, revolutionary, bloodthirsty Paris like a shining comet, with a trail behind her of all that was most distinguished, most interesting in intellectual Europe. Then the climax came. Some smiled indulgently and called it an artistic eccentricity. Others looked upon it as a wise provision, in view of the many events which were crowding thick and fast in Paris just then. But to all, the real motive of that climax remained a puzzle and a mystery. Anyway, Marguerite Saint-Just married Sir Percy Blakeney one fine day, just like that, without any warning to her friends, without a soirée de contrat, or a dîner de fiançailles, or other appurtenances of a fashionable French wedding. How that stupid, dull Englishman ever came to be admitted within the intellectual circle which revolved round the cleverest woman in Europe, as her friends unanimously called her, no one ventured to guess. A golden key is said to open every door, asserted the more malignantly inclined. Enough, she married him, and the cleverest woman in Europe had linked her fate to that damned idiot Blakeney, and not even her most intimate friends could assign to this strange step any other motive than that of supreme eccentricity. Those friends who knew laughed to scorn the idea that Marguerite Saint-Just had married a fool for the sake of the worldly advantages with which he might endow her. They knew, as a matter of fact, that Marguerite Saint-Just cared nothing about money, and still less about a title. Moreover, there were at least half a dozen other men in the cosmopolitan world equally well-born, if not so wealthy as Blakeney, who would have been only too happy to give Marguerite Saint-Just any position she might choose to covet. As for Sir Percy himself, he was universally voted to be totally unqualified for the onerous post he had taken upon himself. His chief qualifications for it seemed to consist in his blind adoration for her, his great wealth, and the high favour in which he stood at the English court. But London society thought that, taking into consideration his own intellectual limitations, it would have been wiser on his part had he bestowed those worldly advantages upon a less brilliant and witty wife. Although lately he had been so prominent a figure in fashionable English society, he had spent most of his early life abroad. His father, the late Sir Algernon Blakeney, had had the terrible misfortune of seeing an idolized young wife become hopelessly insane after 2 years of happy married life. Percy had just been born when the late Lady Blakeney fell a prey to the terrible malady, which in those days was looked upon as hopelessly incurable, and nothing short of a curse of God upon the entire family. Sir Algernon took his afflicted young wife abroad, and there, presumably, Percy was educated and grew up between an imbecile mother and a distracted father until he attained his majority. The death of his parents, following close upon one another, left him a free man, and as Sir Algernon had led a forcibly simple and retired life, the large Blakeney fortune had increased tenfold. Sir Percy Blakeney had travelled a great deal abroad before he brought home his beautiful young French wife. The fashionable circles of the time were ready to receive them both with open arms. Sir Percy was rich, his wife was accomplished, the Prince of Wales took a very great liking to them both. Within 6 months they were the acknowledged leaders of fashion and of style. Sir Percy's coats were the talk of the town, his inanities were quoted, his foolish laugh copied by the gilded youth at Almack's or the Mall. Everyone knew that he was hopelessly stupid, but then that was scarcely to be wondered at, seeing that all the Blakeneys for generations had been notoriously dull, and that his mother had died an imbecile. Thus society accepted him, petted him, made much of him, since his horses were the finest in the country, his fêtes and wines the most sought after. As for his marriage with the cleverest woman in Europe, well, the inevitable came with sure and rapid footsteps. No one pitied him, since his fate was of his own making. There were plenty of young ladies in England, of high birth and good looks, who would have been quite willing to help him to spend the Blakeney fortune, whilst smiling indulgently at his inanities and his good-humoured foolishness. Moreover, Sir Percy got no pity, because he seemed to require none. He seemed very proud of his clever wife, and to care little that she took no pains to disguise that good-natured contempt which she evidently felt for him, and that she even amused herself by sharpening her ready wits at his expense. But then, Blakeney was really too stupid to notice the ridicule with which his clever wife covered him, and if his matrimonial relations with the fascinating Parisienne had not turned out all that his hopes and his dog-like devotion for her had pictured, society could never do more than vaguely guess at it. In his beautiful house at Richmond he played second fiddle to his clever wife with imperturbable bonhomie. He lavished jewels and luxuries of all kinds upon her, which she took with inimitable grace, dispensing the hospitality of his superb mansion with the same graciousness with which she had welcomed the intellectual coterie of Paris. Physically, Sir Percy Blakeney was undeniably handsome, always excepting the lazy, bored look which was habitual to him. He was always irreproachably dressed, and wore the exaggerated, incroyable fashions which had just crept across from Paris to England with the perfect good taste innate in an English gentleman. On this special afternoon in September, in spite of the long journey by coach, in spite of rain and mud, his coat set irreproachably across his fine shoulders. His hands looked almost femininely white as they emerged through billowy frills of finest Mechlin lace. The extravagantly short-waisted satin coat, wide-lapelled waistcoat, and tight-fitting striped breeches set off his massive figure to perfection, and in repose one might have admired so fine a specimen of English manhood, until the foppish ways, the affected movements, the perpetual inane laugh brought one's admiration of Sir Percy Blakeney to an abrupt close. He had lolled into the old-fashioned inn-parlour, shaking the wet off his fine overcoat. Then, putting up a gold-rimmed eyeglass to his lazy blue eye, he surveyed the company, upon whom an embarrassed silence had suddenly fallen.
"How do, Tony? How do, folks?" he said, recognising the two young men and shaking them by the hand. "Zounds, my dear fellow," he added, smothering a slight yawn, "did you ever see such a beastly day? Demmed climate, this?"
With a quaint little laugh, half of embarrassment and half of sarcasm, Marguerite had turned towards her husband and was surveying him from head to foot with an amused little twinkle in her merry blue eyes.
"La!"
said Sir Percy, after a moment or two's silence, as no one offered any comment.
"How sheepish you all look! What's up?"
"Oh, nothing, Sir Percy,"
replied Marguerite, with a certain amount of gaiety, which, however, sounded somewhat forced.
"Nothing to disturb your equanimity, only an insult to your wife."
The laugh which accompanied this remark was evidently intended to reassure Sir Percy as to the gravity of the incident. It apparently succeeded in that, for, echoing the laugh, he rejoined placidly,
"La, my dear, you don't say so. Begad, who was the bold man who dared to tackle you, eh?"
Lord Tony tried to interpose, but had no time to do so, for the young Vicomte had already quickly stepped forward.
"Monsieur,"
he said, prefixing his little speech with an elaborate bow and speaking in broken English,
"my mother, the Countess de Tournay de Basserive, has offenced Madame, who, I see, is your wife. I cannot ask your pardon for my mother. What she does is right in my eyes, but I am ready to offer you the usual reparation between men of honour."
The young man drew up his slim stature to its full height and looked very enthusiastic, very proud, and very hot, as he gazed at 6 foot odd of gorgeousness, as represented by Sir Percy Blakeney, Baronet.
"Lud, Sir Andrew," said Marguerite with one of her merry, infectious laughs, "look on that pretty picture, the English turkey and the French bantam."
The simile was quite perfect, and the English turkey looked down with complete bewilderment upon the dainty little French bantam, which hovered quite threateningly around him.
"La, sir,"
said Sir Percy at last, putting up his eyeglass and surveying the young Frenchman with undisguised wonderment,
"where in the cuckoo's name did you learn to speak English?"
"Monsieur,"
protested the Vicomte, somewhat abashed at the way his warlike attitude had been taken by the ponderous-looking Englishman.
"I protest 'tis marvellous," continued Sir Percy imperturbably. "Demmed marvellous! Don't you think so, Tony, eh? I can't speak the French lingo like that, what?"
"Nay, I'll vouch for that," rejoined Marguerite. "Sir Percy has a British accent you could cut with a knife." "Monsieur,"
interposed the Vicomte earnestly, and in still more broken English,
"I fear you have not understand. I offer you the only possible reparation among gentlemen."
"What the devil is that?"
asked Sir Percy blandly.
"My sword, monsieur,"
replied the Vicomte, who, though still bewildered, was beginning to lose his temper.
"You are a sportsman, Lord Tony,"
said Marguerite merrily.
10-1 on the little bantam."
But Sir Percy was staring sleepily at the Vicomte for a moment or two, through his partly closed heavy lids. Then he smothered another yawn, stretched his long limbs, and turned leisurely away.
"Lud love you, sir,"
he muttered good-humouredly.
"Oh, damn it, young man, what's the good of your sword to me?"
What the Vicomte thought and felt at that moment, when that long-limbed Englishman treated him with such marked insolence, might fill volumes of sound reflections. What he said resolved itself into a single articulate word, for all the others were choked in his throat by his surging wrath.
"A duel, monsieur,"
he stammered. Once more Blakeney turned, and from his high altitude looked down on the choleric little man before him. But not even for a second did he seem to lose his own imperturbable good humour. He laughed his own pleasant and inane laugh, and burying his slender, long hands into the capacious pockets of his overcoat, he said leisurely,
"A duel? La, is that what he meant? Odds fish, you are a bloodthirsty young ruffian. Do you want to make a hole in a law-abiding man? Well, as for me, sir, I never fight duels,"
he added as he placidly sat down and stretched his long, lazy legs out before him.
"Demmed uncomfortable things, duels, ain't they, Tony?"
Now, the Vicomte had no doubt vaguely heard that in England the fashion of duelling amongst gentlemen had been suppressed by the law with a very stern hand. Still, to him, a Frenchman, whose notions of bravery and honour were based upon a code that had centuries of tradition to back it, the spectacle of a gentleman actually refusing to fight a duel was little short of an enormity. In his mind he vaguely pondered whether he should strike that long-legged Englishman in the face and call him a coward, or whether such conduct in a lady's presence might be deemed ungentlemanly, when Marguerite happily interposed.
"I pray you, Lord Tony," she said in that gentle, sweet, musical voice of hers, "I pray you play the peacemaker. The child is bursting with rage, and," she added with a soupçon of dry sarcasm, "might do Sir Percy an injury."
She laughed a mocking little laugh, which, however, did not in the least disturb her husband's placid equanimity.
"The British turkey has had the day," she said. "Sir Percy would provoke all the saints in the calendar and keep his temper the while."
But already Blakeney, good-humoured as ever, had joined in the laugh against himself.
"Damn smart, that, now, wasn't it?" he said, turning pleasantly to the Vicomte. "Clever woman, my wife, sir. You'll find that out if you live long enough in England."
"Sir Percy is in the right, Vicomte," here interposed Lord Antony, laying a friendly hand on the young Frenchman's shoulder. "It would hardly be fitting that you should commence your career in England by provoking him to duel." For a moment longer the Vicomte hesitated, then, with a slight shrug of the shoulders directed against the extraordinary code of honour prevailing in this fog-ridden island, he said with becoming dignity,
"Ah, well, if Monsieur is satisfied, I have no griefs. You, milor, are our protector. If I have done wrong, I withdraw myself."
"I do," rejoined Blakeney with a long sigh of satisfaction. "Withdraw yourself over there. Damned excitable little puppy," he added under his breath. "Faith, folks, if that's a specimen of the goods you and your friends bring over from France, my advice to you is drop a mid-channel, my friend, or I shall have to see old Pitt about it. Get him to clap on a prohibitive tariff and put you in the stocks, and you smuggle."
"Alas, Sir Percy, your chivalry misguides you," said Marguerite coquettishly. "You forget that you yourself have imported one bundle of goods from France."
Blakeney slowly rose to his feet, and making a deep and elaborate bow before his wife, he said with consummate gallantry,
"I had the pick of the market, madame, and my taste is unerring."
"More so than your chivalry, I fear," she retorted sarcastically.
"What's life, my dear? Be reasonable. Do you think I'm going to allow my body to be made a pincushion of by every little frog-eater who don't like the shape of your nose?"
"Well, that's Sir Percy," laughed Lady Blakeney as she bobbed him a quaint and pretty curtsy. "You need not be afraid. 'Tis not the men who dislike the shape of my nose."
"Afraid be damned. Do you impugn my bravery, madame? I don't patronize the ring for nothing, do I, Tony? I put up the fists with Red Sam before now, and he didn't get it all his own way either."
"Faith, Sir Percy," said Marguerite with a long and merry laugh that went echoing along the old oak rafters of the parlour, "I would I had seen you then. You must have looked a pretty picture, and to be afraid of a little French boy."
echoed Sir Percy good-humouredly.
"La, madame, you honour me. Zooks! Folks, mark ye that. I've made my wife laugh. The cleverest woman in Europe. Odds fish, we must have a bowl on that."
And he tapped vigorously on the table near him.
"Hey, Jelly, quick, man. Here, Jelly."
Harmony was once more restored. Mr. Jellyband, with a mighty effort, recovered himself from the many emotions he had experienced within the last half hour.
"A bowl of punch, Jelly, hot and strong, eh?"
said Sir Percy.
"The wits that have just made a clever woman laugh must be whetted. Hasten, my good Jelly."
"Nay, there is no time, Sir Percy," interposed Marguerite. "The skipper will be here directly, and my brother must get on board, or the Daydream will miss the tide."
"Time, my dear? There's plenty of time for any gentleman to get drunk and get on board before the turn of the tide."
"I think, your ladyship," said Jellyband respectfully, "that the young gentleman is coming along now with Sir Percy's skipper."
"That's right," said Blakeney. "Then Armand can join us in the merry bowl. Think you, Tony," he added, turning towards the Vicomte, "that jackanapes of yours will join us in a glass? Tell him that we drink in token of reconciliation."
"In fact, you are all such merry company," said Marguerite,
that I trust you will forgive me if I bid my brother good-bye in another room."
It would have been bad form to protest. Both Lord Antony and Sir Andrew felt that Lady Blakeney could not altogether be in tune with them at that moment. Her love for her brother Armand Saint-Just was deep and touching in the extreme. He had just spent a few weeks with her in her English home, and was going back to serve his country, at a moment when death was the usual reward for the most enduring devotion. Sir Percy also made no attempt to detain his wife. With that perfect, somewhat affected gallantry which characterized his every movement, he opened the coffee-room door for her, and made her the most approved and elaborate bow which the fashion of the time dictated, as she sailed out of the room without bestowing on him more than a passing, slightly contemptuous glance. Only Sir Andrew Ffoulkes, whose every thought since he had met Suzanne de Tournay seemed keener, more gentle, more innately sympathetic, noted the curious look of intense longing, of deep and hopeless passion, with which the inane and flippant Sir Percy followed the retreating figure of his brilliant wife.
Chapter 7. The Secret Orchard. Once outside the noisy coffee-room, alone in the dimly lighted passage, Marguerite Blakeney seemed to breathe more freely. She heaved a deep sigh, like one who had long been oppressed with the heavy weight of constant self-control, and she allowed a few tears to fall unheeded down her cheeks. Outside, the rain had ceased, and through the swiftly passing clouds the pale rays of an after-storm sun shone upon the beautiful white coast of Kent and the quaint, irregular houses that clustered round the Admiralty Pier. Marguerite Blakeney stepped onto the porch and looked out to sea. Silhouetted against the ever-changing sky, a graceful schooner with white sails set was gently dancing in the breeze. The Daydream it was, Sir Percy Blakeney's yacht, which was ready to take Armand Saint-Just back to France, into the very midst of that seething, bloody revolution which was overthrowing a monarchy, attacking a religion, destroying a society, in order to try and rebuild upon the ashes of tradition a new utopia, of which a few men dreamed, but which none had the power to establish. In the distance two figures were approaching the Fisherman's Rest. One, an oldish man with a curious fringe of grey hairs round a rotund and massive chin, and who walked with that peculiar rolling gait which invariably betrays the seafaring man. The other, a young, slight figure, neatly and becomingly dressed in a dark, many-caped overcoat. He was clean-shaved, and his dark hair was taken well back over a clear and noble forehead. "Armand," said Marguerite Blakeney, as soon as she saw him approaching from the distance, and a happy smile shone on her sweet face, even through the tears. A minute or two later, brother and sister were locked in each other's arms, while the old skipper stood respectfully on one side.
"How much time have we got, Briggs?" asked Lady Blakeney, "before Monsieur Saint-Just need go on board."
"We ought to weigh anchor before half an hour, your ladyship," replied the old man, pulling at his grey forelock.
Linking her arm in his, Marguerite led her brother towards the cliffs.
"Half an hour," she said, looking wistfully out to sea. "Half an hour more and you'll be far from me, Armand. Oh, I can't believe that you are going, dear. These last few days, whilst Percy has been away and I've had you all to myself, have slipped by like a dream."
"I'm not going far, sweet one," said the young man gently. "A narrow channel to cross, a few miles of road. I can soon come back."
"It is not the distance, Armand, but that awful Paris, just now."
They had reached the edge of the cliff. The gentle sea breeze blew Marguerite's hair about her face and sent the ends of her soft lace fichu waving round her like a white and supple snake. She tried to pierce the distance far away beyond which lay the shores of France, that relentless and stern France which was exacting her pound of flesh, the blood tax from the noblest of her sons.
"Our own beautiful country, Marguerite," said Armand,
who seemed to have divined her thoughts.
"They are going too far, Armand," she said vehemently. "You are a republican, so am I. We have the same thoughts, the same enthusiasm for liberty and equality. But even you must think that they are going too far."
"Hush," said Armand instinctively, as he threw a quick, apprehensive glance around him.
"Ah, you see, you don't think yourself that it is safe even to speak of these things here in England."
She clung to him suddenly with strong, almost motherly passion.
"Don't go, Armand," she begged. "Don't go back. What should I do if... If... Her voice was choked in sobs. Her eyes, tender, blue and loving, gazed appealingly at the young man, who, in his turn, looked steadfastly into hers.
"You would in any case be my own brave sister," he said gently, "who would remember that, when France is in peril, it is not for her sons to turn their backs on her."
Even as he spoke, that sweet, childlike smile crept back into her face, pathetic in the extreme, for it seemed drowned in tears.
"Oh, Armand," she said quaintly, "I sometimes wish you had not so many lofty virtues. I assure you little sins are far less dangerous and uncomfortable. But you will be prudent," she added earnestly. "As far as possible, I promise you. Remember, dear, I have only you to care for me."
"Nay, sweet one, you have other interests now. Percy cares for you." A look of strange wistfulness crept into her eyes as she murmured,
"He did. Once.
But surely..."
There, dear, don't distress yourself on my account. Percy is very good."
"Nay," he interrupted energetically, "I will distress myself on your account, my Margot. Listen, dear, I have not spoken of these things to you before. Something always seemed to stop me when I wished to question you. But somehow I feel as if I could not go away and leave you now without asking you one question. You need not answer it if you do not wish," he added as he noted a sudden hard look, almost of apprehension, darting through her eyes.
"What is it?"
she asked simply. "Does Sir Percy Blakeney know that... I mean, does he know the part you played in the arrest of the Marquis de Saint-Cyr?" She laughed, a mirthless, bitter, contemptuous laugh, which was like a jarring chord in the music of her voice.
"That I denounced the Marquis de Saint-Cyr, you mean? To the tribunal that ultimately sent him and all his family to the guillotine?" "Yes, he does know. I told him after I married him."
"You told him all the circumstances which so completely exonerated you from any blame?"
"It was too late to talk of circumstances. He heard the story from other sources. My confession came too tardily, it seems. I could no longer plead extenuating circumstances. I could not demean myself by trying to explain. And now I have the satisfaction, Armand, of knowing that the biggest fool in England has the most complete contempt for his wife."
She spoke with vehement bitterness this time, and Armand Saint-Just, who loved her so dearly, felt that he had placed a somewhat clumsy finger upon an aching wound.
"But Sir Percy loved you, Margot," he repeated gently. "Loved me. Well, Armand, I thought at one time that he did, or I should not have married him. I dare say..." she added, speaking very rapidly, as if she were glad at last to lay down a heavy burden which had oppressed her for months. "I dare say that even you thought, as everybody else did, that I married Sir Percy because of his wealth. But I assure you, dear, that it was not so. He seemed to worship me with a curious intensity of concentrated passion which went straight to my heart. I never loved anyone before, as you know, and I was 24 then, so I naturally thought that it was not in my nature to love. But it has always seemed to me that it must be heavenly to be loved blindly, passionately, wholly, worshipped, in fact. And the very fact that Percy was slow and stupid was an attraction for me, as I thought he would love me all the more. A clever man would naturally have other interests, an ambitious man other hopes. I thought that a fool would worship and think of nothing else, and I was ready to respond, Armand. I would have allowed myself to be worshipped and given infinite tenderness in return."
She sighed, and there was a world of disillusionment in that sigh. Armand Saint-Just had allowed her to speak on without interruption. He listened to her, whilst allowing his own thoughts to run riot. It was terrible to see a young and beautiful woman, a girl in all but name, still standing almost at the threshold of her life, yet bereft of hope, bereft of illusions, bereft of those golden and fantastic dreams which should have made her youth one long, perpetual holiday. Yet perhaps... though he loved his sister dearly, perhaps he understood. He had studied men in many countries, men of all ages, men of every grade of social and intellectual status, and inwardly he understood what Marguerite had left unsaid. Granted that Percy Blakeney was dull-witted, but in his slow-going mind there would still be room for that ineradicable pride of a descendant of a long line of English gentlemen. A Blakeney had died on Bosworth Field. Another had sacrificed life and fortune for the sake of a treacherous Stuart, and that same pride, foolish and prejudiced, as the Republican Armand would call it,
must have been stung to the quick on hearing of the sin which lay at Lady Blakeney's door. She had been young, misguided, ill-advised, perhaps. Armand knew that. And those who took advantage of Marguerite's youth, her impulses and imprudence, knew it still better. But Blakeney was slow-witted. He would not listen to circumstances. He only clung to facts, and these had shown him Lady Blakeney denouncing a fellow man to the tribunal that knew no pardon, and the contempt he would feel for the deed she had done, however unwittingly, would kill that same love in him, in which sympathy and intellectuality could never have had a part. Yet even now his own sister puzzled him. Life and love have such strange vagaries. Could it be that with the waning of her husband's love, Marguerite's heart had awakened with love for him? Strange extremes meet in love's pathway. This woman, who had had half-intellectual Europe at her feet, might perhaps have set her affections on a fool. Marguerite was gazing out towards the sunset. Armand could not see her face, but presently it seemed to him that something which glittered for a moment in the golden evening light fell from her eyes onto her dainty fichu of lace. But he could not broach that subject with her. He knew her strange, passionate nature so well, and knew that reserve which lurked behind her frank, open ways. They had always been together, these two, for their parents had died when Armand was still a youth and Marguerite but a child. He, some 8 years her senior, had watched over her until her marriage, had chaperoned her during those brilliant years spent in the flat in the Rue de Richelieu, and had seen her enter upon this new life of hers here in England with much sorrow and some foreboding. This was his first visit to England since her marriage, and the few months of separation had already seemed to have built up a slight, thin partition between brother and sister. The same deep, intense love was still there on both sides, but each now seemed to have a secret orchard into which the other dared not penetrate. There was much Armand Saint-Just could not tell his sister. The political aspect of the revolution in France was changing almost every day. She might not understand how his own views and sympathies might become modified, even as the excesses committed by those who had been his friends grew in horror and in intensity. And Marguerite could not speak to her brother about the secrets of her heart. She hardly understood them herself. She only knew that, in the midst of luxury, she still felt lonely and unhappy. And now Armand was going away. She feared for his safety. She longed for his presence. She would not spoil these last few sadly sweet moments by speaking about herself. She led him gently along the cliffs, then down to the beach. Their arms linked in one another's, they still had so much to say that lay just outside that secret orchard of theirs. Chapter 8. The Accredited Agent. The afternoon was rapidly drawing to a close, and a long, chilly English summer's evening was throwing a misty pall over the green Kentish landscape. The Daydream had set sail, and Marguerite Blakeney stood alone on the edge of the cliff for over an hour, watching those white sails which bore so swiftly away from her the only being who really cared for her, whom she dared to love, whom she knew she could trust. Some little distance away to her left, the lights from the coffee-room of the Fisherman's Rest glittered yellow in the gathering mist. From time to time, it seemed to her aching nerves as if she could catch from thence the sound of merrymaking and of jovial talk, or even that perpetual senseless laugh of her husband's, which grated continually upon her sensitive ears. Sir Percy had had the delicacy to leave her severely alone. She supposed that, in his own stupid, good-natured way, he may have understood that she would wish to remain alone, while those white sails disappeared into the vague horizon so many miles away. He, whose notions of propriety and decorum were supersensitive, had not suggested even that an attendant should remain within call. Marguerite was grateful to her husband for all this. She always tried to be grateful to him for his thoughtfulness, which was constant, and for his generosity, which really was boundless. She tried, even at times, to curb the sarcastic, bitter thoughts of him, which made her, in spite of herself, say cruel, insulting things which she vaguely hoped would wound him. Yes, she often wished to wound him, to make him feel that she too held him in contempt, that she too had forgotten that once she had almost loved him. Loved that inane fop, whose thoughts seemed unable to soar beyond the tying of a cravat or the new cut of a coat.
Bah!
And yet, vague memories that were sweet and ardent and attuned to this calm summer's evening came wafted back to her memory on the invisible wings of the light sea breeze. The time when first he worshipped her. He seemed so devoted, a very slave. And there was a certain latent intensity in that love which had fascinated her. Then suddenly that love, that devotion, which throughout his courtship she had looked upon as the slavish fidelity of a dog, seemed to vanish completely. 24 hours after the simple little ceremony at old Saint-Roch, she had told him the story of how, inadvertently, she had spoken of certain matters connected with the Marquis de Saint-Cyr before some men, her friends, who had used this information against the unfortunate Marquis and sent him and his family to the guillotine. She hated the Marquis. Years ago, Armand, her dear brother, had loved Angèle de Saint-Cyr, but Saint-Just was a plebeian, and the Marquis full of the pride and arrogant prejudices of his caste. One day Armand, the respectful, timid lover, ventured on sending a small poem, enthusiastic, ardent, passionate, to the idol of his dreams. The next night he was waylaid just outside Paris by the valets of the Marquis de Saint-Cyr and ignominiously thrashed. Thrashed like a dog within an inch of his life, because he had dared to raise his eyes to the daughter of the aristocrat. The incident was one which in those days, some 2 years before the Great Revolution, was of almost daily occurrence in France. Incidents of that type, in fact, led to the bloody reprisals, which, a few years later, sent most of those haughty heads to the guillotine. Marguerite remembered it all. What her brother must have suffered in his manhood and his pride must have been appalling. What she suffered through him and with him she never attempted even to analyze. Then the day of retribution came. Saint-Cyr and his kind had found their masters in those same plebeians whom they had despised. Armand and Marguerite, both intellectual, thinking beings, adopted with the enthusiasm of their years the utopian doctrines of the Revolution, while the Marquis de Saint-Cyr and his family fought inch by inch for the retention of those privileges which had placed them socially above their fellow men. Marguerite, impulsive, thoughtless, not calculating the purport of her words, still smarting under the terrible insult her brother had suffered at the Marquis's hands, happened to hear, amongst her own coterie, that the Saint-Cyrs were in treasonable correspondence with Austria, hoping to obtain the Emperor's support to quell the growing revolution in their own country. In those days one denunciation was sufficient. Marguerite's few thoughtless words anent the Marquis de Saint-Cyr bore fruit within 24 hours. He was arrested. His papers were searched. Letters from the Austrian Emperor promising to send troops against the Paris populace were found in his desk. He was arraigned for treason against the nation and sent to the guillotine, whilst his family, his wife and his sons shared this awful fate. Marguerite, horrified at the terrible consequences of her own thoughtlessness, was powerless to save the Marquis. Her own coterie, the leaders of the revolutionary movement, all proclaimed her as a heroine. And when she married Sir Percy Blakeney, she did not perhaps altogether realize how severely he would look upon the sin which she had so inadvertently committed, and which still lay heavily upon her soul. She made full confession of it to her husband, trusting to his blind love for her, her boundless power over him, to soon make him forget what might have sounded unpleasant to an English ear. Certainly, at the moment he seemed to take it very quietly. Hardly, in fact, did he appear to understand the meaning of all she said. But what was more certain still was that never after that could she detect the slightest sign of that love, which she once believed had been wholly hers. Now they had drifted quite apart, and Sir Percy seemed to have laid aside his love for her as he would an ill-fitting glove. She had tried to rouse him by sharpening her ready wit against his dull intellect, endeavoured to excite his jealousy if she could not rouse his love, tried to goad him to self-assertion, but all in vain. He remained the same, always passive, drawling, sleepy, always courteous, invariably a gentleman. She had all that the world and a wealthy husband can give to a pretty woman. Yet on this beautiful summer's evening, with the white sails of the Daydream finally hidden by the evening shadows, she felt more lonely than that poor tramp who plodded his way wearily along the rugged cliffs. With another heavy sigh, Marguerite Blakeney turned her back upon the sea and cliffs, and walked slowly back towards the Fisherman's Rest. As she drew near, the sound of revelry, of gay, jovial laughter, grew louder and more distinct. She could distinguish Sir Andrew Ffoulkes' pleasant voice, Lord Tony's boisterous guffaws, her husband's occasional drawly, sleepy comments. Then, realizing the loneliness of the road and the fast-gathering gloom round her, she quickened her steps. The next moment she perceived a stranger coming rapidly towards her. Marguerite did not look up. She was not the least nervous, and the Fisherman's Rest was now well within call. The stranger paused when he saw Marguerite coming quickly towards him, and, just as she was about to slip past him, he said very quietly,
"Citoyen Saint-Just."
Marguerite uttered a little cry of astonishment at thus hearing her own familiar maiden name uttered so close to her. She looked up at the stranger, and this time, with a cry of unfeigned pleasure, she put out both her hands effusively towards him.
"Chauvelin!" she exclaimed. "Himself, citoyen, at your service," said the stranger, gallantly kissing the tips of her fingers.
Marguerite said nothing for a moment or two, as she surveyed with obvious delight the not very prepossessing little figure before her. Chauvelin was then nearer 40 than 30, a clever, shrewd-looking personality with a curious fox-like expression in the deep sunken eyes. He was the same stranger who, an hour or two previously, had joined Mr. Jellyband in a friendly glass of wine.
"Chauvelin, my friend," said Marguerite with a pretty little sigh of satisfaction, "I am mightily pleased to see you."
No doubt poor Marguerite Saint-Just, lonely in the midst of her grandeur and of her starchy friends, was happy to see a face that brought back memories of that happy time in Paris, when she reigned, a queen, over the intellectual coterie of the Rue de Richelieu. She did not notice the sarcastic little smile, however, that hovered round the thin lips of Chauvelin.
"But tell me," she added merrily, "what in the world, or whom in the world, are you doing here in England?"
She had resumed her walk towards the inn, and Chauvelin turned and walked beside her.
"I might return the subtle compliment, fair lady," he said. "What of yourself?"
"Oh, I," she said with a shrug of the shoulders. "Je m'ennuie, mon ami, that is all."
They had reached the porch of the Fisherman's Rest, but Marguerite seemed loath to go within. The evening air was lovely after the storm, and she had found a friend who exhaled the breath of Paris, who knew Armand well, who could talk of all the merry, brilliant friends whom she had left behind. So she lingered on under the pretty porch, while through the gaily lighted dormer window of the coffee-room came sounds of laughter, of calls for Sally and for beer, of tapping of mugs and clinking of dice, mingled with Sir Percy Blakeney's inane and mirthless laugh. Chauvelin stood beside her, his shrewd, pale, yellow eyes fixed on the pretty face, which looked so sweet and childlike in this soft English summer twilight.
"You surprise me, citoyenne," he said quietly, as he took a pinch of snuff.
"Do I now?"
she retorted gaily. "Faith, my little Chauvelin, I should have thought that with your penetration you would have guessed that an atmosphere composed of fogs and virtues would never suit Marguerite Saint-Just."
"Dear me, is it as bad as that?" he asked in mock consternation.
"Quite," she retorted.
"And worse."
"Strange. Now, I thought that a pretty woman would have found English country life peculiarly attractive."
"Yes, so did I," she said with a sigh.
"Pretty women," she added meditatively, "ought to have a good time in England, since all the pleasant things are forbidden them, the very things they do every day."
"Quite so."
"You'll hardly believe it, my little Chauvelin," she said earnestly, "but I often pass a whole day, without encountering a single temptation."
"No wonder," retorted Chauvelin gallantly, "that the cleverest woman in Europe is troubled with ennui." She laughed, one of her melodious, rippling, childlike laughs.
"It must be pretty bad, mustn't it?" she said archly, "or I should not have been so pleased to see you."
"And this within a year of a romantic love match."
"Yes, a year of a romantic love match. That's just the difficulty."
"Ah, that idyllic folly," said Chauvelin with quiet sarcasm, "did not then survive the lapse of weeks?"
"Idyllic follies never last, my little Chauvelin. They come upon us like the measles, and are as easily cured."
Chauvelin took another pinch of snuff. He seemed very much addicted to that pernicious habit so prevalent in those days. Perhaps, too, he found the taking of snuff a convenient veil for disguising the quick, shrewd glances with which he strove to read the very souls of those with whom he came in contact.
"No wonder," he repeated with the same gallantry, "that the most active brain in Europe is troubled with ennui."
"I was in hopes that you had a prescription against the malady, my little Chauvelin."
"How can I hope to succeed in that which Sir Percy Blakeney has failed to accomplish?"
"Shall we leave Sir Percy out of the question for the present, my dear friend?" she said dryly.
"Ah, my dear lady, pardon me, but that is just what we cannot very well do," said Chauvelin, whilst once again his eyes, keen as those of a fox on the alert, darted a quick glance at Marguerite. "I have a most perfect prescription against the worst form of ennui, which I would have been happy to submit to you, but—"
"But what?"
"There is Sir Percy."
"What has he to do with it?"
"Quite a good deal, I am afraid. The prescription I would offer, fair lady, is called by a very plebeian name. Work."
"Work?"
Chauvelin looked at Marguerite long and scrutinizingly. It seemed as if those keen, pale eyes of his were reading every one of her thoughts. They were alone together. The evening air was quite still, and their soft whispers were drowned in the noise which came from the coffee-room. Still, Chauvelin took a step or two from under the porch, looked quickly and keenly all round him, then, seeing that indeed no one was within earshot, he once more came back close to Marguerite.
"Will you render France a small service, citoyenne?" he asked, with a sudden change of manner which lent his thin, fox-like face singular earnestness.
"La, man," she replied flippantly, "how serious you all look of a sudden. Indeed, I do not know if I would render France a small service. At any rate, it depends upon the kind of service she, or you, want."
"Have you ever heard of the Scarlet Pimpernel, citoyen Saint-Just?" asked Chauvelin abruptly.
"Heard of the Scarlet Pimpernel?" she retorted with a long and merry laugh. "Faith, man, we talk of nothing else. We have hats a la Scarlet Pimpernel. Our horses are called Scarlet Pimpernel. At the Prince of Wales' supper party the other night we had a souffle a la Scarlet Pimpernel. Lud," she added gaily, "the other day I ordered at my milliner's a blue dress trimmed with green, and bless me if she did not call that a la Scarlet Pimpernel."
Chauvelin had not moved while she prattled merrily along. He did not even attempt to stop her when her musical voice and her childlike laugh went echoing through the still evening air. But he remained serious and earnest whilst she laughed, and his voice, clear, incisive, and hard, was not raised above his breath as he said,
"Then, as you must have heard of that enigmatical personage, citoyenne, you must also have guessed and known that the man who hides his identity under that strange pseudonym is the most bitter enemy of our republic, of France, of men like Armand Saint-Just."
"La," she said with a quaint little sigh, "I dare swear he is. France has many bitter enemies these days."
"But you, citoyenne, are a daughter of France, and should be ready to help her in a moment of deadly peril."
"My brother Armand devotes his life to France," she retorted proudly. "As for me, I can do nothing here in England."
"Yes, you,"
he urged still more earnestly, whilst his thin, fox-like face seemed suddenly to have grown impressive and full of dignity.
"Here in England, citoyenne, you alone can help us. Listen, I have been sent over here by the Republican government as its representative. I present my credentials to Mr. Pitt in London tomorrow. One of my duties here is to find out all about this League of the Scarlet Pimpernel, which has become a standing menace to France, since it is pledged to help our cursed aristocrats, traitors to their country and enemies of the people, to escape from the just punishment which they deserve.
You know as well as I do, citoyenne, that once they are over here, those French émigrés try to rouse public feeling against the Republic.
They are ready to join issue with any enemy bold enough to attack France. Now, within the last month, scores of these émigrés, some only suspected of treason, others actually condemned by the Tribunal of Public Safety, have succeeded in crossing the Channel. Their escape in each instance was planned, organized, and effected by this society of young English jackanapes, headed by a man whose brain seems as resourceful as his identity is mysterious. All the most strenuous efforts on the part of my spies have failed to discover who he is. Whilst the others are the hands, he is the head, who, beneath this strange anonymity, calmly works at the destruction of France.
I mean to strike at that head, and for this I want your help. Through him, afterwards, I can reach the rest of the gang. He is a young buck in English society, of that I feel sure. Find that man for me, citoyenne, he urged. Find him for France.
Marguerite had listened to Chauvelin's impassioned speech without uttering a word, scarce making a movement, hardly daring to breathe. She had told him before that this mysterious hero of romance was the talk of the smart set to which she belonged. Already before this, her heart and her imagination had been stirred by the thought of the brave man who, unknown to fame, had rescued hundreds of lives from a terrible, often an unmerciful fate. She had but little real sympathy with those haughty French aristocrats, insolent in their pride of caste, of whom the Comtesse de Tournay de Basserive was so typical an example. But republican and liberal-minded though she was from principle, she hated and loathed the methods which the young republic had chosen for establishing itself. She had not been in Paris for some months. The horrors and bloodshed of the Reign of Terror, culminating in the September massacres, had only come across the Channel to her as a faint echo. Robespierre, Danton, Marat, she had not known in their new guise of bloody justiciaries, merciless wielders of the guillotine. Her very soul recoiled in horror from these excesses, to which she feared her brother Armand, moderate republican as he was, might become one day the Holocaust. Then, when first she heard of this band of young English enthusiasts, who, for sheer love of their fellow men, dragged women and children, old and young men, from a horrible death, her heart had glowed with pride for them. And now, as Chauvelin spoke, her very soul went out to the gallant and mysterious leader of the reckless little band, who risked his life daily, who gave it freely and without ostentation for the sake of humanity. Her eyes were moist when Chauvelin had finished speaking. The lace at her bosom rose and fell with her quick, excited breathing. She no longer heard the noise of drinking from the inn. She did not heed her husband's voice or his inane laugh. Her thoughts had gone wandering in search of the mysterious hero. Ah, there was a man she might have loved, had he come her way. Everything in him appealed to her romantic imagination, his personality, his strength, his bravery, the loyalty of those who served under him in the same noble cause, and, above all, that anonymity which crowned him, as if with a halo of romantic glory. Find him for France, citoyenne. Chauvelin's voice close to her ear roused her from her dreams. The mysterious hero had vanished, and, not 20 yards away from her, a man was drinking and laughing to whom she had sworn faith and loyalty. "La, man," she said with a return of her assumed flippancy, "you are astonishing. Where in the world am I to look for him?"
"You go everywhere, citoyenne," whispered Chauvelin insinuatingly. "Lady Blakeney is the pivot of social London, so I am told. You see everything, you hear everything."
"Easy, my friend," retorted Marguerite, drawing herself up to her full height and looking down with a slight thought of contempt on the small, thin figure before her.
"Easy. You seem to forget that there are 6 feet of Sir Percy Blakeney and a long line of ancestors to stand between Lady Blakeney and such a thing as you propose."
"For the sake of France, citoyenne," reiterated Chauvelin earnestly.
"Tush, man, you talk nonsense anyway, for even if you did know who this Scarlet Pimpernel is, you could do nothing to him, an Englishman."
"I take my chance of that," said Chauvelin with a dry, rasping little laugh. "At any rate, we could send him to the guillotine, first to cool his ardour, then, when there is a diplomatic fuss about it, we can apologise humbly to the British government, and, if necessary, pay compensation to the bereaved family."
"What you propose is horrible, Chauvelin," she said, drawing away from him as from some noisome insect. "Whoever the man may be, he is brave and noble, and never, do you hear me, never would I lend a hand to such villainy."
"You prefer to be insulted by every French aristocrat who comes to this country?"
Chauvelin had taken sure aim when he shot this tiny shaft. Marguerite's fresh young cheeks became a thought more pale, and she bit her underlip, for she would not let him see that the shaft had struck home.
"That is beside the question," she said at last with indifference. "I can defend myself, but I refuse to do any dirty work for you or for France. You have other means at your disposal. You must use them, my friend."
And without another look at Chauvelin, Marguerite Blakeney turned her back on him and walked straight into the inn.
"That is not your last word, citoyenne," said Chauvelin, as a flood of light from the passage illumined her elegant, richly clad figure. "We meet in London, I hope."
"We meet in London," she said, speaking over her shoulder at him, "but that is my last word." She threw open the coffee-room door and disappeared from his view, but he remained under the porch for a moment or two, taking a pinch of snuff. He had received a rebuke and a snub, but his shrewd, fox-like face looked neither abashed nor disappointed. On the contrary, a curious smile, half sarcastic and wholly satisfied, played around the corners of his thin lips.